Hello, my name is J. Lewis Mills, for On the Level with J. Lewis Mills. I need you to do me a favor. I need you to lend me something. I need you to lend me your ear, and I need you to lend me your common sense. I need you to come join me. I need to talk to you. You need to talk to me. It's about time that we let it all out. Join me. I want to hear from you. Hello, 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 my goodness. It's so great to be with you all again. It's me, J. Lewis Mills, here on bbsradio.com/on the level with On the Level with J. Lewis Mills. You can call in to our show tonight. The number is 1-888-429-5471. Again, that's 888-429-5471. So, we are here for show number two. Last week was show number one. I did get some feedback from people that listened. And by the way, thank you very, very kindly to everyone that took time to not only listen to my show when it was live last week, but then also the ones that went and listened to the archive show days afterward. I greatly appreciate all of the attention. I greatly appreciate the feedback that I received from last week's show. Just gives me more motivation and inspiration to keep doing what I'm doing. Tonight, it's going to be a little bit of a heavy show, but I really think that this is a subject that needs to be talked about. When I first found out that my guest had something to do with this, it sparked my interest a little bit, so I did my own little research. But it's great to have my guest that's here with us tonight. Her name is Christina Zorich. Christina Zorich is an actress. She's an acting teacher. She's a director and a producer. Currently, right now, her current project is called The New Abolitionists, which is a documentary on human sex trafficking, and currently it is in post-production. Basically, what New Abolitionist is about is she follows and interviews various committed individuals whose lives have been directly dedicated to anti-trafficking work in Southeast Asia. Now, my connection with Ms. Zorich is she was my first acting teacher, my first real acting teacher. when I decided that acting was something I wanted to take seriously. And I had a very, very hard time in the beginning with, you know, understanding everything. And one day in class, Ms. Zorich, she's a bit of a fiery person, but she said to me one day in her Christina Zorich voice, "God damn it, J. Lewis, if you would stop acting like you're acting, you would get this." So I said, "Okay, can you just explain to me, show me what you mean?" And she explained what she meant, and when I say the floodgates opened, as far as me getting it, that was my very first breakthrough, and I will always attribute some level of success, a portion of any success that I have, to Miss Christina Zorich. So, Christina, how are you doing, ma'am?
Well, thank you for the very generous introduction. First of all, your talent is your own. It has nothing to do with me. And God forgive me for cursing, because I'm a very devout Christian. Did I really say that horrible curse word? God forgive me. So I repent of that right now.
Yes, ma'am, you did. Yeah, but it worked. It worked. So, you know.
Yeah, well, there must have been a better way to say it. We know there must have been a better way. But thank you for your generous introduction.
The Lord works in mysterious ways. Let's just leave it there.
Well, anyway, thank you for having me on your show. This is awesome. You're a talented guy, and I'm glad and excited for you that you have this opportunity, this hour show for yourself. Yeah.
Thank you. So tell me a little bit. As I said when I was introducing you, you know, when I found out that you had something to do with this, my very first question was, how did you even get started in this? Who brought this to you? I want to hear that story.
Okay, I was at a Christmas party in the Hollywood Hills 5.5 years ago with a friend. Actually, Tony and I went. A student was having a party, and I met a woman named Erica Grieve. She was, at that point, had started an NGO, a non-government organization called Unlikely Heroes. She had been a nurse and was working in hospitals and was telling me that a lot of children and women were coming in who had been trafficked. And she told me at that point in time, there wasn't a system, a recuperative system in place to help rehabilitate them. And she found a yearning and a call to make that her kind of purpose. And so she told me, I want to build homes and I want to rescue women and children from trafficking and help restore them. And I know this is, it's shameful in a way. I had never heard of it. I had seen a few movies with a few through lines where, yes. storylines with it. But I didn't understand the depth of what it was. And I'm still, it's an ever evolving process of learning about what this criminal industry is about. Where I started and where I am now are very different things. You evolve and develop and deepen your understanding. But so I threw at her a bunch. I was like, what can I do to help you? She started discussing what it was about and what it is. And I just, I felt like this sense of destiny, like I had to help her. And I threw her a bunch of directors that I knew that would come on and help. What she needed was materials to fundraise to build the home. And okay. So I wanted to help. I sent her directors to help her do that. And all of them wanted money, which is, of course, reasonable. But this was a Christian organization that was doing charity. This is a huge charity organization that was set up to, do this work of restoration. So okay. I said to her, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry about this. And she's like, no problems, but, the funds have to go to the girls, though. And I said, of course, of course. And at that time, I thought, you know what, this is a documentary. What is she doing? I mean, if at that time I felt, if I had no idea about this and the realities of what this is, there must be other people out there like me who are not aware and educated. And so she and I met once or twice before, and she told me some more stories, because then she went to the Philippines and started a home there. And after some time, we tried to connect, but I didn't end up being of service to her the way I really wanted to. And time passed, and a few years, and I sold my apartment back in New York, and with the funds that I made from that, I was going to produce a product, and that didn't work out. And I really, after that fell apart, I started thinking, I want to do something that I really, really care about, that really means a lot to me. And I spent a lot of time in prayer and significant amount of time before I kind of really realized, okay, this is where my heart is. This is, and then a friend of mine told me about a conference that was happening, Women on the Front Lines in Los Angeles, hosted by Patricia King. And she has a ministry called XP Ministries. And at the end of the conference, they interviewed a lot of victims. And I was heart-wrenched, some of the stories. And they played them during the conference. And she stated, along with James Gall, I think, that their goal was to end trafficking in our lifetime. And I was like, I was hooked. I wanted to be a part of, whatever she was doing. I looked up on her website, found out they do missions trips, and I went on my first missions trip to Southeast Asia, where they had a missions base run by Andrea Aysen, who is one of the abolitionists in the documentary. And in the time that I was there, Patricia introduced us to all these different anti-trafficking Christian missionaries that had NGOs and were doing anti-trafficking work. And I came back, I knew it was kind of exploratory research. In the back of my head, I wasn't 100% positive, am I going to do this? And once I got back, Patricia was incredibly generous. Andrea was incredibly generous. All the people I met on the way were, I mean, it was a life-changing experience. I filmed that trip. But I knew when I came back, I didn't have a movie, and I knew I had to plan and get ready to really shoot. And so then spent the next, I think, year preparing. And then this last fall, went back for a month and a half and shot and went specifically to four different NGOs and followed people and interviewed people that worked there, kind of asking the questions that, to me, I feel like anyone would want to know. And it's been a journey. It's been a life-changing experience for me. This last, I think altogether, I would say it's probably somewhere between 3 years and 2.5 years that I've been focused on this. So yeah, that's and right now we're in post-production. If anyone wants to check us out, you can go to www.thenewabolitionistdoc.com, and a lot of what I just said is on my website, on that website, but other information as well about who we are. And also our Indiegogo campaign is on that page as well, if you want to contribute and help fund, help us along with this post-production phase. So
that's absolutely I'm going to figure out how to post your Indiegogo info on my page on the level, the bbsradio.com/onthelevel.
Once
this is over, I'll get with my people and figure out exactly how to do that. So we'll definitely try and take care of you there. Absolutely. Now, when you went on this initial mission, how long was that? And what did you find any type of indifference against you filming, against you coming in with a camera? Did people feel like they didn't want to be on camera?
Well, this whole thing is, shooting this subject matter is in essence, there's, I say to people all the time, it's like my Noah's Ark. It's like crazy because it's a criminal industry. So, of course, no one wants to be on camera. So, and you don't want to be exploitative, but you want to capture it. So there's one or two people we're pixelating in the project, and you have to be creative in the way you shoot sometimes. And so absolutely, we did some undercover shooting the second time. The first time I got into a situation where I almost got hit by somebody who was drunk, a kind of sex tourist who, I was shooting. And I kind of went in there not really understanding what I was getting into and kind of very much like, not really kind of equipped or prepared in any way. So that first trip was really exploratory. The women, of course, would hide. There was a time where I was shooting, and some of the girls, these young girls who were shooting in Pattaya, were in Thailand, got hostile. There was one of the guys on the Christian, on the group with us, a Christian missionary who's a friend of mine now, who was on the missions trip, who kind of protected me because he would see me wandering off and, was almost guarding me. But yeah, I mean, it's a very, and then there's other stuff like, there's some stuff. The first trip as well, there was was one street we went down, Walking Street in Pattaya. And at the end of the street, there was a child, bordello and brothel. And the street was so kind of dark and difficult to get down. Me and a group left before because it was a long outreach we did that night. But Patricia and a few other people got to the end of the block and got there. And I mean, it was very, I think the hardest thing, besides the danger, besides the fact that you're trying to capture something that, you know, is dangerous to capture, besides the fact that you're constantly thinking about, you know, not wanting to exploit and, you know, there's so many factors. But I feel like what ends up happening is you kind of get to the point, I think, at the end of it where I kind of just, there was a part of me that was just so determined to figure this out, to understand what this was. And I basically, there was also another part of me that felt like, is this really happening? Is this real? No. And it happened to my cameraman when we went back the second time. We would see, you know, a child with a man or something at a bar, and we would find out from the missionary who was kind of taking us there that this was an area where pedophiles bought children, and that this was probably a date that this person was on with a child. And my cameraman did a little bit what I did the first time, where he would go, well, how do we know, and this and that. And then, because the mind doesn't want to accept it, it's so vile and so horrific and so horrible. There's a part of us that can't believe it's real, this level of, abuse is kind of, there's no other way to put it but this evil. So, you kind of don't want to look at it. You don't want to, your mind can't wrap itself around it. But eventually, and the other thing that started, that happened my first time is I could identify the sex tourist. You could really, you really very strongly can feel like something off about them or some kind of sex addiction there. And eventually you kind of, you go through different stages. My initial stages were like disgust. Well, first there was denial. Then there was like a disgust about it. And then there was like anger and frustration. And then the second trip, I actually talked to some of these abolitionists, these people involved in this anti-trafficking work, and they started telling me some of the stories of these men. And you realize, my gosh, these guys are just wrecked. Their lives are, I actually came to a place of feeling sorry for them and feeling more sympathy and more... it's an interesting journey you go through with the subject matter. But initially, I was like, very volatile, and it was really difficult to even like confront it. And if I didn't feel like, on some level, there's no other way to put this, but I felt like it was a divine assignment that I had laid aside for me, and that, like it or not, that I had some form of a mission. I felt like a dog with a bone. Like, is this it? What is this? If it is this, then it has to be revealed. It has to be exposed. It has to be seen. It has to be looked at. Even though it was really difficult at first to do so, even for myself, a lot of the footage that first trip was just unusable because of my reactions. But, I think the second time I went and I was more... prepared. I kind of metered myself. I knew when I had to stop and I had to check out for a day, or, I had to be easier on myself and there. So that's kind of, it's kind of a smorgasbord of things come up when you deal with this subject matter. It really is.
You have J. Lewis Mills, bbsradio.com on the level with J. Lewis Mills. You can reach Christina, ask her any questions you want. If you have anything to add, if you have any questions to ask her, 1-888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. We are going to take a quick break, but when we come back, Christina, you mentioned earlier about you almost got hit in a situation. if you could go through and tell us exactly what happened in that situation when we come back, I would greatly appreciate it.
Of course.
All right. Thank you very kindly. We will be back in 2 minutes. BBSRadio.com. Coming back to On the Level with J. Lewis Mills, we are here with executive producer and director of The New Abolitionist, Christina Zorich. And Christina, before we went to break, you were talking about your different experiences when you were on your mission, as well as when you were filming this a particular portion of your documentary. And you had mentioned that you had almost gotten hit. And I was just hoping that you could better elaborate on that to really give my listeners a picture of what you went through and what these women go through every day, what their real life is.
Well, I was on the street, and as I said, I was, this is a, it's called non-applause. It's a main kind of, it's an area where there's prostitution and where there's different bars where it goes on. What happened is I was shooting in the morning, and there was a man who came down the street. I started shooting him and asked if I could shoot him. And he was with a woman. He was clearly a sex tourist, and she was clearly, you know, a sex worker. And they were walking towards me, and she was just being very kind of shy. But he was like, at first he said yes, and then he said no, and then he started asking me why I was doing this. And he started kind of careening towards me, and it was early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And it became clear the closer he got that he was very drunk. And then he got very angry as he started coming towards me. He started kind of like, not rushing me, but a little bit like getting volatile. And she literally stood between us. And she looked in my eyes, and she said, look in her eyes. She's good. She's good. She's good. She's good. Leave her alone. She's a good person. And he said, well, this can't be on anything on, you know, you can't use, put this on your Facebook or anything. Like, he thought that I was just a tourist, but it was, in other words, he knew what he was doing. He didn't want it documented. He didn't want it to be seen, but he's in public. So, yes. You know, you can put, and, but she really rescued me there. She really came in and stopped him and was very kind to me. And I remember at the time I was very moved by it because God knows what her life is. But for her to step in and intercede to protect me was really moving to me. And I, you know, I really did not know what I was getting into. I really vaulted myself into this situation and have learned as I go what it is and the kind of the psychological ramifications of doing certain things and how this can affect adversely this person or that person, because a lot of shooting this kind of stuff is like that. So
how much research did you... I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
How much research did you do before, you said you didn't know what you were getting into, before you went on your first mission, how much research did you do to even learn about sex trafficking?
Yeah, I watched every book I could get my hand on, every movie, every TV interview. I read articles. I read like 3 books. I spent the time before I was preparing for the trip really educating myself about the realities of human sex trafficking. One book that blew my mind was by Patricia King called For His Tears I Died. And it was, I actually told her, I was like, you've got to make this into a movie. I still think it's individual testimonies of children who have, who talk about, who have come out of the experience of being trafficked and tell their story. And it's just, it's so breathtaking, these stories, so moving and so powerful. Some of them are tricked. Some of them are sold by relatives. I mean, young kids.
Wow.
The stories are horrific. I mean, everything you can imagine happens to them. Abuse. There's begging trafficking rings. There's baby trafficking rings. There's a thing called virgin sales where certain young girls are sold as virgins to the highest bidder, and then I could get into more graphic stuff, but and then there's also young children in the book who, boys who have been sold into work camps, fishing boats, or to use as slave labor, sexually abused by their, not allowed to sleep. I mean, it's slavery. It's modern day slavery, and it's happening to children and women who don't have the power or don't have the voice or the strength to defend themselves. And it's going on for exploitative reasons. I mean, there's rings of or cartels that exist around the globe, and it manifests differently in different countries for different reasons that are trafficking and moving around children and women for the purpose of sex and for work. And because they know, I mean, it's vile what's happening, and it needs to be stopped, and we all need to get educated, and we need to get activated. We need to, this is why, you know, when I say that it was like, I was like a dog with a bone, once I found out it was going on, I became like, you know, like, this has to be stopped. This has to be, you know, my big thing that I used to say was there needs to be global task forces in every country, in every state, you know, just dedicated to this work. And I do believe that that's true still. Like, that is the solution. We all need to contact our senators, and we all need to contact our congressmen and let them know that this is an important matter, and that it has to be on, has to be something that they're attacking, and that we care about this issue. I mean, most of the NGOs that I've talked to, the individuals that are doing this, like, work, seriously, you know, dedicated their lives, sold everything, moved to, you know, into organizations that support what they're doing and then are doing anti-trafficking work. They all say, you know, that this, we went in, the last 10 years has been like almost an awakening and education to this criminal industry. And they all are saying, now it's time to get active and stop it. Because I'll tell you one statistic that, you know, a few statistics stay with you. You can't kind of get them out of your brain. But
yes.
I was going to be following Christian Elliott at A21, and he said to me, Christina, in Southeast Asia, and this is probably true for most places, and again, it's hard because statistics, you know, we're talking about a criminal industry, so it's a very difficult thing to really get hard, fast statistics on it. Okay, because you don't know what's going on fully because it's a criminal industry. It's underground. It's hidden. But he said 1% of this criminal industry is being prosecuted. So that figure, I just could not let go of that. It was easier for us to, for myself and my, you know, my production group, all of us, to really find people to interview or discuss or follow when they were doing rescue work or restoration work or preventative work. But it was very difficult to get connected to the prosecution work because it's not going on to the level that it needs to. I mean, these people that we followed and interviewed are valiantly making huge breakthroughs, and miracles are happening every day because of the work they're doing. So that's the good news, because they're rescuing, they're pulling children and women out of this every day. We're working towards it and reaping real rewards. So they're saving lives.
You mentioned that this is an underground industry, which clearly it is. So when I ask my next question, I'm not asking, when I say, how is this possible? I don't mean, how is it legal? I mean, how are people able, has your documentary taken you to a place where you could figure out how these quote unquote sex tourists are finding out about these places? Or for, like you said, that there's auctions. How are these auctions being, I don't want to say advertised, because clearly they're not advertised, but how do people find out about this to make it such a big industry?
Well, one thing that I've heard from one of the, I mean, this is, I am telling you what I've learned from these people, because they're so educated and steeped in it. So I've never even gone on this thing, but one of the big tools people use is the dark web, which I know nothing about. I've never tried to get on it. I don't know anything about it. But there is, I mean, if you think about it, if you live, a lot of the, when you go to Southeast Asia, a lot of the sex tourists are the same profile. I hate to say it, but a lot of them, I'm not saying it's not, all different nationalities and races there, because there are, but predominantly it's white men, and they're coming from all over the globe. And so if you think about it, if you come from America to Vietnam or Cambodia or Thailand or wherever they're going to, you know, do what they're doing, and there's different types of profiles of the kind of sex tourists that that you see. Some of them go for relationships with people, with underage girls or children. Some of them go for they go just for a lark, for a crazy weekend or week or whatever, you know, like it's kind of dramatized in, say, you know, movies or stuff, like this crazy outing. And then other people go for, you know, just a small amount of time, and they're sex addicts. And they've planned this, and they're, you know, I mean, they're not able to do it in their own country because, you know, we all know legally how we all perceive all of this. So,
yes.
And it's perceived that way there too. It's just very underground. The reason it's taken root, the big issue that I saw, and then of course you're asking all the questions I asked, J. Lewis. That's the progression you're going through is what I went through, which is, you're like, well, why is this happening? How is this possible? Why did it take root here so much? And all that stuff.
Yeah.
Because I was told Southeast Asia is the most trafficked region of the globe. Now, that might be true and it might not. People are debating it, but it's certainly very alive and booming, this criminal industry. And I spent a lot of time researching that, and what I found was a few things. Number one, there was a huge war. Traffickers feed off of families, children, women, boys, men who are at risk. Poverty is one of the, I mean, any child or young person who comes from no education and who's desperate, who can't feed themselves, and comes from a broken family where maybe one of the family members is, an addict, or another has had no education, or there's divorce, or there's, you know, something like that. They end up being considered what's called at risk, meaning they're vulnerable. Like a friend of mine did some missionary work in France with some refugees from Syria, and he said that in the camp, some of the children and women went missing, and they were talking about it when he was there. And they're suspicious that they were trafficked. So
they were in the camp, and they went missing, and nobody.
I'm saying that that this criminal industry is targeting people who are vulnerable, and children and women that are vulnerable. They go into the slums in Cambodia and they target families that are poor, that don't have enough food to eat. And sometimes, I mean, one woman who we followed told me that she told me a few stories of traffickers going in and targeting pregnant women in the slums and trying to buy their child out of their belly before they even give birth. Now, families have more than one kid, so the parents are sit there in the, you know, with this moral crisis of, well, if I sell this child, I can feed, you know, I mean, it's horrible. It's horrendous that these, that this is, they're exploiting these families and these like this, but that's the face of it, you know?
Is there any research or any data? Now, listen, I'm not asking this saying that American children are more important than any other children. That is absolutely not why I'm asking this question. But I am asking, does the sex trafficking industry, to the degree you are talking about in Southeast Asia, does that resonate? Does that live in? Is that in? Have there been any cases of American children being sold into sex trafficking or anything else?
Well, I mean, this is happening all over the globe. It's happening everywhere. Again, another reason why I think it's the most true, I was told initially by some people involved in anti-trafficking work that Southeast Asia is considered the number one hub, Bangkok being kind of the center of it. And then two was Mexico, and three was America and Europe. Now, it's a criminal industry, so tracking this, I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't work for the Secret Service.
Sure.
Assignment with this. So it's not, you get my point. I mean,
yes,
if they
had
hard, fast answers and they could identify this, they would be able to deal with it properly. But I think one of the reasons that I came to, during the war in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there was not just one war, but there was conflicts in the whole area of Southeast Asia between communism and democracy. And I had to do historical research, and people, you know, educated me along the way. And I still have way more to go about the subject matter. But the bottom line is those conflicts happened in each country in Southeast Asia. We obviously know about Vietnam because we were engaged in defending democracy in that region. The presence of the soldiers there exasperated it. When there's war and people don't have food, and people are, and the climate is volatile, and it creates another at-risk scenario for the people who live in those countries. As well, for the reason it happens so extremely in Cambodia is because of the Khmer Rouge. Have you ever heard of the movie The Killing Fields? It's
yes.
A movie that kind of, if anyone, you know, you want to get a sense of what happened. There was a horrendous genocide in Cambodia. Pol Pot was like this death spot, evil kind of communist figure that came in and just decimated Cambodia over the course of really 4 years. But the level of trauma the country's still living with. I mean, we went into a restaurant in Siem Reap, which is where Angkor Wat is, which is that famous, I think they shot the movie, the Lara Croft movie in Angkor Wat. And anyway, which is, I think, how Angie Jolie became involved with I think that's why she went there.
Tomb Raider?
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, the bottom line is there is a what was I talking about? What was I just saying in Angkor Wat?
You were telling about a place that you went.
We were in this restaurant in Siem Reap, And this, the waiter, the oh no, it was the owner of the place came up and we started talking, me and the cameraman, and he just said, point blank, this country is traumatized. They're still traumatized from the Khmer Rouge, which was the communist genocide that happened in that country. A lot of the systems are broken. There was all development of the country stopped for a bunch of years because of it. I went there kind of aware but not fully aware of the devastation of what happened to that country. And they're still recovering. They're still recovering from the after effects of it. It was a brutal, horrific, vile genocide, and it traumatized people, and generations are still healing from it. So
this whole story to me is, like I said earlier, I did my own research before speaking to you tonight, but just hearing your firsthand accounts of a lot of it, it's making it more real. More real for me than any type of research that I can do. We're getting ready to take a break, but when we come back, I would like to get into specifically talking about some of the people that you followed and interviewed in your documentary. You're here with J. Lewis Mills on the Level with J. Lewis Mills, bbsradio.com/onthelevel. We will be back right after this. J. Lewis Mills. I'm here with Christina Zorich. She is the director and producer of the documentary The New Abolitionist, which is in post-production now. Christina, one of the parts, I don't know if this is your whole documentary, but one of the parts of your documentary is you follow and you interview people that their lives were directly affected by this. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about some of the people that you actually met, interviewed, how you met them, and if you still have a relationship with them today?
Everybody we interviewed and met with, we left everything on great terms. And Andrea was so generous, who heads up XP Missions in Cambodia. She's really a noble. That's one of the things that I really instinctually did. When I was reading all the books and watching all the movies, and it was necessary that I did that, I was focusing on the problem. But what I loved instinctually about how this all came about, because I certainly didn't consciously plan it, I instinctually went to how do we solve it? Who's solving it? And then honoring and learning from them and following them and kind of garnering what I can in terms of knowledge and understanding and solution from them. So I really wanted to focus instinctually on how do we fix this? How do we stop this? How do we solve this? And so everybody we interviewed gave us a piece of the puzzle. So that was profound and moving for me. One of the most powerful stories, I think, that it stuck with me. There's a lot of them. Every single person who we interviewed or who's involved in this work is my hero. Okay. I look up to and I learn from and I respect. Just being able to be with them fills you with hope and joy because of who they are and what they've dedicated their lives to. So just being in their presence, you feel that. But the story, one of the stories that sticks out is when we were working with Destiny Rescue, which is an Australian NGO where that is doing rescue, restoration, preventative, and prosecution work over in Southeast Asia. But one of the women we interviewed was telling us about a success story. This girl went through rehabilitation. They rescued her, got her out.
What is her name?
With what's called, I can't say anything. You know, I can't okay. even use the name. I don't even okay. know if I'm permitted to use the name of the woman who okay. was, that's another thing. You can't, some people don't want their name used, you know, just to, because okay. if the criminal industry finds out what they're doing, they'll try to stop it. So it's a very yeah. dangerous situation, and we, even though we want them on camera and we want to use their names naturally so that the audience can invest in them and care, if their identity isn't protected, they can't literally do the work that they're doing so incredibly beautifully anymore. It's over for them because they'll
that
be
makes
outed
sense.
For what
I,
they're doing. Yeah,
I apologize so for asking.
No, it's not your fault. I mean, how would you know that unless you're there? You know, I learned that there too. So anyway, one of the stories, one of these young girls went back to this poor village she came from after being restored and from, you know, having been trafficked. And her father was an alcoholic and was a fisherman, and all of his nets were broken and they were very poor, and he didn't have the skill set to restore the nets. And she had learned other skills, because they teach other skills, but one skill that served her, she learned how to sew in as a part of her, you know, rehabilitation. They try to find what skill set they can train them in, so that, you know, how do you get out of poverty? You learn a skill, you learn a craft. For me, learning how to act, learning how to teach, every new skill set you learn is another stream of income you have coming into your household. So what she did is she taught this her father how to, she sewed up his nets, and then he started fishing and his business started improving. And she went and she also helped him stop drinking. And suddenly her family started doing well economically. And she went back and became like kind of a role model in town with other families, and the father ended up helping. So I just thought it was a beautiful story, because she ended up being, you know, trafficked into a life of a lot of abuse, exploitation, horrendous trauma. And after her healing, she went back and rescued those around her and her family. I just thought that was so inspirational, to think the power of one life, you know?
The majority of the people that you followed around, were they activists or abolitionists working for the cause, or were the majority of the people that you interviewed people that this was their reality?
Some of them had come out of it, and some of them had just been drawn to this work. Most of them were Christians, and they just felt a heart for this work and really good-hearted people, just deeply good-hearted people. And I would say everybody kind of, well, certain people stay in one area of kind of mm-hmm. the work, and then others do all of it, you know, because there's four areas. There's rescue, restoration, prevention, and prosecution. So most of them do all of it. They work in different kind of ways, just four different ways to attack it, to kind of stop it.
Okay.
Yeah. Shine light okay. on this stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, it makes a lot of sense. It really does. Thank you very much, Christina, for coming on and just telling us your story, telling us what your documentary is about. As I said, I am going to put your Indiegogo information on my page. But in closing, what would you like to leave with my listeners?
I just would like to leave that, and I'm, you know, even though we're in some difficult times right now, to me, this is a bipartisan issue. This is not about politics. Children and women being exploited and tortured in work environments, sexual environments. This should kind of rise above all of our differences, and I really feel that this needs to be a hot button issue. And I feel like governments, Congress, the Senate, countries have to get involved. We all have to, even though it's ugly and hard to face and look at and confront, the one thing I've learned through doing this work and focusing on this subject matter for the last few years is that the only way it's going to be impeded is by people confronting it and speaking out against it and taking action against it and not being not shying away because it's so vile to face, but having the courage and the strength to stand up to it. So that's what I really hope for everybody listening, that they get educated, they get aligned with an NGO. You can look up XP Ministries. You can look up Tamar Center. You can look up Nightlight International. You can look up Destiny Rescue. And if you go to the website of the movie, we list all those organizations, and you can go to the What Can I Do page, and you can click on the link for those different NGOs and find a way to get involved. It can be one of those four. And also, Coffee Commitment is a business that's started by a friend of mine who's deeply dedicated to anti-trafficking work. So purchase a product where a portion of the proceeds goes back into anti-trafficking work. I mean, that's it. I drink Coffee Commitment now. I used to drink other coffees, but why shouldn't I put my dollar towards a product that's doing work that I deeply believe in, as opposed to put it elsewhere? So we all have a voice. We all have a part to play in ending this. I just would encourage listeners, get involved.
Okay. And what are your websites again? You can say all of whatever websites you want to give right now. You have the floor to do so.
Well, I'm just going to make it real simple. Go to the New Abolitionists, plural. So with an S at the end of abolitionist, doc.com, and our Indiegogo campaign is there. Another radio interview I did is there with some more information about the subject matter. Then there's also the page with all the different NGOs that we feature in the documentary. There's some history about trafficking, some more about who we are, our identity as a company, and they'll get more information there. So I would do that. But I just really want, my heart is to be a voice, one of the voices that activates all of us into ending this. That's my heart. That's it. Simple, finito. That's it.
Very well said. Thank you. Thank you once again, Christina, for joining me. Yeah, people, we just really have to do better. It is a bit disappointing to me that such a serious topic isn't one of the, as Ms. Zorich said, it's not one of the hotbed issues, and it needs to be. And if you're one of these people that says, oh, I just can't hear about that, oh, I just can't think about that, with all due respect, fuck you. And I mean it exactly like that. I mean it exactly like that. Because if you can't listen to it, if you can't think about it, if you can't read about it, if you can't watch it, just imagine what the children and the women have to go through that are actually going through it. okay? On a daily basis, victims of such a tragedy as this, they can't say, I don't want to talk about this today. I don't want to think about this today. If you don't want to talk about it, if you don't want to think about it, do something about it so that it gets stopped, so you don't have to talk about it, so you don't have to think about it. Does get me a little upset. It really does, because I see and I know what the important things in this country are, and sex trafficking is not one of them. And that's sad. We would much rather spend our time and our money on some straight-laced bullshit instead of doing something to help someone else. And to me, I just say shame on all of us, myself included. I didn't know anything about this until Ms. Zorich brought it to my attention. I feel ashamed because I feel like I'm somebody that does care. I feel like I am somebody that does try to go out of my way to help people. But I'm just not doing the right research. So
well,
shame on
you. You can't do anything about it till you know about it. Now you know about it, and you know, I think the important thing is knowledge is power. Once you know something, you can't unlearn it. So watch movies, read books about it, investigate, research different organizations that are committed to anti-trafficking work. I mean, you know, this is such horrendous, a kind of vile thing. You can't beat yourself up, Jay Lewis, and I don't think anyone really can, for not being able to fathom it, you know?
I mean, I'm not necessarily, I appreciate that to the highest degree, I honestly do, but I'm not talking about beating myself up, and I don't want anybody else to beat their self up either. You're absolutely right. What I'm saying is, I really honestly think that we should really sit and check our priorities at the door. That's what I'm saying as a people. And because I'm saying that, I'm not trying to exclude myself from, I'm not really one that likes being included in the masses. But in this sense, I'm just saying, you know, we really need to check our priorities at the door. We really need to sit and reevaluate what we believe is important and what we believe is not important. So that's really basically all I'm saying. I wasn't, you know, necessarily trying to get negative, but at the end of the day, sometimes you have to be a little negative to get a positive reaction. So I'm just trying to wake people up. I know I've been woken up. And I know that I am now going to try and do what I can, no matter how big, no matter how small. I think whatever I or whatever anyone else does, as long as you're doing something, it's better than nothing. So as Ms. Zorich said, just go to the website. Go and see what you can do. See where you can. If it's only just, as she said, buying products that portion of the money gets donated to, you know, it doesn't even have to be to this, you know, anything that is better for humanity, anything that is better to help each other as well as excel human rights. I say we should go out and try our very best to get more involved in good things instead of just frivolous things. So again, I thank you, Ms. Christina. We've gone over time again. I apologize, Doug, but sometimes you have to do it in order to get your point across. Join me next week, same time, same station, station 2, bbsradio.com/onthelevel. I will continue giving the phone number of 888-429-5471. I'm just thinking, everybody's just agreeing with everything I'm saying, so nobody wants to call and debate. I guess I have to go into my bag of tricks and find a debatable conversation, because I would really, really like to hear from you. Thank you for joining me. I hope you have a very great week. Inspire yourself. Motivate yourself. It's all within you. Thank you very much. See you next week. We are out. Are you inspired? Can I inspire you more? Come join me every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. on Station 2 here at BBS Radio. Let's get inspired together. Come join me. You'll be glad you did.